Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, on location. Today, we're going to learn about how environmental toxins impair our immune system, even over multiple generations. University of Rochester has the article. We'll share it with you. It was published in the preview journal, Cell Press Science. Also today, we're going to have a guest in the second part of our program, Dr. Thomas Cowan. He is a professor out in the San Francisco area, and we're going to talk about new perspectives on cancer. And what's important about this discussion, we're going to show why we have lost the war on cancer, why it's failed. But those of us who are using non-toxic and alternative approaches are succeeding. So that'll be an interesting discussion. Also today, Richard Gale will be coming on to address some issues. We're going to give some very positive solution-based insights to Greta Thunberg and all of the other millions of young people on what they can do themselves in small groups, individually, collectively, to start impacting the environment. So without creating, let's say, an apocalyptic image, because they're too young for that image, we don't want to in any way, let's say, alter their perception of having a positive and healthy future. So we're balancing it by showing here's what needs to be done, but it's only when the wealthiest people in the world decide to work together. And right now they're not deciding that. They're working together only to commodify and commercialize what we're calling green capitalism. And we're going to show you why that's not good, but she is good. And if there's anyone who can motivate kids to go vegan and to start doing good things, we're going to list all the different good things that can be done, brand new things that we have been working on over the last few days. Also today, I'm going to give you a perspective from a journalist, Isabel Attard. That's Attard. And she has written an article for Frack Free, Europe, which is a very important green publication. And it was a look behind the scenes at who's controlling Greta Thunberg. And Isabel, by the way, served as the green deputy for the French Department of Calvados. And she's a very committed green person. She's a person that believes in helping the environment, but not necessarily doing it through commercial means. So we're going to hear what she did in her investigation. And she found some very disturbing facts that almost everything we learned about Greta was a setup. Now, mind you, she has no political agenda. She's not right. She comes from a liberal background. But we reviewed the article carefully before deciding to share it with you today and to show you how they're set aside Greta. She's real. She's legitimate. She's an extraordinarily remarkable young girl. She's only 16, but she is the voice for millions, and we need her, and we need to support her. But we do not need the people behind her who are manipulating her. So that's going to be today also. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. And this comes from University of Rochester. New research shows that maternal exposure, mother's exposure, to a common and ubiquitous form of industrial pollution can harm the immune system of the baby, but also when that child grows up and has children, those children will also have subsequent immune responses, weakening the body's defenses against infections like the influenza virus. Professor Lawrence, the University of Rochester's Medical Center, did the research. And there's an interesting statement I'll read from Dr. Lawrence's. This is, quote, "The old adage, you are what you eat, is a touchstone for many aspects of human health. But in terms of the body's ability to fight off infections, This study suggests that in a certain extent, you may also be what your great-grandmother ate. Now, there have been many studies, by the way, that have shown that environmental exposure to pollutants can have effects on the reproductive, respiratory, and nervous system function across multiple generations. And new research shows for the first time that the immune system is impacted as well. So we're talking about multi-generational weakening of the immune system can help explain variations that are observed during seasonal and, let's say, flu episodes. So just something to think about. And it works on the other side as well. So let's say you grew up in a family where they were very conscious of good food and exercise and not being sedentary. That can pass down through generations. So it works both ways. From Marshall University, a study about eating simply two handfuls of walnuts a day can help prevent breast cancer. Now, what do we know? This was published in the Prairie View Journal of Nutrition Research. By the way, Marshall University is in my home state of West Virginia. What we know now, and we've known for some time, this is not the first study. 40 years ago, Loma Linda University in California was doing research on nuts and seeds and came to similar conclusions. But walnuts are known for being one of the most nutritious nuts on the planet. They also happen to be excellent sources of healthy fats and antioxidants, which in turn help fight disease and turn off inflammation. So there's a lot of studies, hundreds of studies on this tree nut and its association with lower risk of heart disease, better improved brain function, but now cancer prevention of breast cancer. So that's important because eating walnuts alters the expression of certain genes in breast tumors, which ultimately impedes the growth of cancer cells and leads to cancer cell death. So I read the article. It was very interesting. And so get a handful or two of walnuts. You're getting the omega-3 fatty acids. You're getting alpha-linolenic acid. You're getting plant sterols, beta-cystosterol. And that can stop the proliferation of cancer cells in cell culture. So that's good. And we want to give you everything that can help save lives. From Johns Hopkins University comes a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Network Open, that fragmented physical activity is actually linked to a greater death risk. What do I mean? According to Johns Hopkins University, although reduced physical activity during the day is widely seen as a harbinger of death in older people, meaning the more you sit, the greater likelihood you will die. And also, we see fragmentation of physical activity, spreading daily activity across more episodes of brief activity, may be an earlier indicator of death risk than total amount of daily activity. This was important, and so what is the suggestion? Just so you understand, fragmentation of physical activity is what most people engage in. They'll do a little bit of something, and then they go back to doing nothing. Then they'll do a little bit more. It is much better to do your exercise, let's say 45 minutes in the morning, nonstop, like power walking, or bicycling, something where you're aerobic. But also, later in the day, you can do another 45 minutes, and then you do resistance exercise, pull-ups, sit-ups, push-ups, curls, anything that is causing the muscle to have to expand. And then within that resistance, as well as in the morning with aerobic, a part of that, at least 4 minutes, should be intense. Really let the stops out. And that is the perfect way of exercising. And that actually lengthens your telomeres, which are the end caps of your chromosomes, and provides you for a longer life. From the Harbin Medical University in China, they're talking about Siberian ginseng. It's also known as Eleuthero. E-L-E-U-T-H-E-R-O. It's a member of a family whose benefits and uses are similar to Asian ginseng, which is Panax, P-A-N-A-X ginseng. In traditional Chinese medicine, Siberian ginseng is known for its positive effects on qi, spleen, and kidneys. Now, numerous research characterized the chemical component A-senecosis and found that they possess therapeutic activities. And a very important article written in Harbin Medical University discussed the findings of the pharmacological properties of A-senecosis. And the paper was published in the Journal of the American Medical Chinese Medicine. And what it is this. Siberian ginseng, as opposed to Asian or Panax ginseng, has a very strong anti-cancer potential. So that's good to know. Ginseng is not expensive, easy to obtain, and has just dozens of benefits. I mean, I suggest it because it strengthens people who are weak's immune system. Those who need like an energy tonic, and athletes in particular that I help train, it's a general, what is called adaptogen stimulant. It helps prevent respiratory tract infections, it helps prevent colds, it helps prevent the flu. So, and by the way, very few Americans have ever tried Siberian ginseng. It's been almost forgotten, but it's the perfect adaptogen and energy booster. And the chemical name, the scientific name is A, the letter A, and then Senti, S-E-N-T-I, Cosus, C-O-S-U-S, Senticosus. And it's used for all the health and stimulating ways we can. So let me just give you a reason, probably for the first time in your life, to try Siberian ginseng versus Panax ginseng. They're both good. In fact, when I was going to do a debate on ginseng 40 years ago, the doctor who debated me said there was no benefit to it. And I had one single volume with 5,000 separate scientific peer review studies. So the host looked and said, well, this is odd. You know, so you're in one of those kind of embarrassing moments. If you're a host and you haven't done your homework, you have a medical doctor saying this is all garbage crap, and I'm sitting there with 5,000 scientific studies. Now, there's where you get a cognitive disconnect. We want to believe the medical doctor. We want to believe the authority figure. We want to believe that person who is believed by others in their field. We don't want to believe some lay person. And yet the lay person had the truth, the doctor, just biased. Here's what I can tell you with absolute scientific certainty. Here is what we know Siberian ginseng will do. Anti-fatigue. Improve your immune system. It's an immune modulator. It enhances cognitive function. It improves rapid wound healing. It prevents ulcers. It reduces blood pressure. It improves menopausal symptoms. It's neuroprotective. It stabilizes blood glucose. There's all your diabetics and pre-diabetics, and it enhances lymphatic function. So, and that's because of its active component present in the A-senecosis. It's a range of phytochemicals that are responsible for the biological activity that you're not getting in anything else you're eating. It's that simple. From the University of Ottawa, circulating selenium, that's a micro, meaning small amount, micrograms, selenium concentration is inversely associated with the prevalence of a stroke, meaning that when you have too little selenium, you're more likely to have a stroke. If you have adequate amounts of selenium, you're more likely to prevent a stroke. How much do I suggest? 200 micrograms, MCG, not milligrams, micrograms, a day. And if you're more susceptible, you're overweight or you suffer from diabetes or insulin resistance, then maybe 200 micrograms twice a day. Also from the University of Seville, which is in Spain, inadequate control of thyroid hormones sensitizes to hepatocarcinogenesis and unhealthy aging. It sounds like a, you know, that's just the topic. What the authors are showing in this study is that using wild type and Pax-X models of hypothyroidism in this study, you know what? This is so complex. I'm talking about TSH and how it stimulates T4 and T3 in the thyroid gland. I'm going to refer you instead to an article that Dr. Martin Feldman and I wrote in lay language that's fully scientific based on the thyroid gland. So anyone who's gaining weight and can't understand why, if your eyebrows are beginning to thin and you don't know why, if you're losing hair around 40 to 45 years of age and you don't know why, if you're suffering from fatigue, if you have, when the room is hot and you don't feel hot, when you put covers on at night and your feet are still cold and your hands are still cold, if you find yourself having ups and downs in energy, you may have an out-of-balance thyroid gland. And therefore, instead of going through T3, T4, high TSH levels and what it means, read the article. It'll take you about 15 minutes, but it'll give you a real education on rebalancing your hormone. And also, we're told in life, get over it. Suck it up, get over it. Okay, and a lot of people can do that, but a lot of people can't. And this is an interesting story from Georgia State University. Early life stress from racial discrimination puts African Americans at a greater risk of accelerated aging, a marker for premature development of serious health problems, and perhaps a shorter life expectancy. That's according to Sierra Carter, a professor in psychology at the university. So quite simply, if you've been discriminated against as a child, it could precipitate more susceptibility to depression and accelerated aging. It's not going to be in everyone, but at least for some people, and if you don't understand why they might be out of balance emotionally, then it may be because of early life discrimination. It's just another piece to the puzzle of life that it's not one size fits all, but for those who have not looked in that, it might be beneficial. Also, I have to have a whole series of medical tests done every year, mainly for insurance purposes. And I oppose some of the tests, and they say, okay, write a letter and sign it, but you still got to take the test. Or I would be de-insured. So I take all the tests, and when I say a lot of tests, I mean it's every test you can imagine I have to take. And during this process, one of the tests I have to take is a cardiovascular stress test. And after the test, the cardiologist was sitting with me saying, I find this a little irregular. I said, why? He says, your markers are way down. I said, yeah, my resting pulse is down, my blood pressure is less. That's because I'm a long-distance athlete, have been my whole life. And my heart's different, and this is true of all long-distance athletes. And he opened his drawer and he said, thought you'd like to see this. And he takes out fish oil, coenzyme Q10, magnesium, and ajuno, and some other herbs. And he said, I take these every day. It's good for you. I said, if every American, we're talking about adults, 18 and over, if they took 6 compounds a day in adequate amounts to their needs, coenzyme Q10, let's say between 1 and 600 milligrams, I'm not talking about for medical purposes, which could be much higher, cayenne at a high heat unit, 1 capsule 3 times a day, magnesium at 400 milligrams twice a day, vitamin E at 400 to 800 units once a day, and L-carnitine, C-A-R-T-I-N-E, at 2,000 milligrams. A, you're going to help if you have AFib to correct your irregular heartbeat. I've done that in so many people. you can't imagine, where they were supposed to take drugs, you know, see the commercials. Well, that's their knowledge. There are other knowledge ways of approaching it. And he said, you take aspirin? I said, I would never take aspirin. Why not? Well, because everything you just saw thins your blood. Vitamin C thins your blood. Vitamin E thins your blood. And green juices thin your blood. Having an onion thins your blood. Well, my blood's plenty thin, and you don't have aggregation. And also, the aspirin causes the thinning, yes, which can help prevent a stroke, yes, but it also destroys vitamin C, folic acid, B6, and B12, which then increases your likelihood of having homocysteine, which is a major factor for a heart attack. So you prevent a stroke and die of a heart attack? I don't see the benefit. Where's the trade-off? This is not something, when you're talking about your health, of a zero-sum gain. This is a negative consequence. But if you took what I'm talking about, you would both prevent a heart attack and a stroke. He said, you're right. I don't take aspirin. I said, but do you tell your patients to? Yeah, I have to. Do you give them statins? I have to. Statins are garbage. Why would you do that? He said, look, what a doctor does in their own life is one thing. What they're told to do, and the state medical boards make sure you do, is a different matter. I said, do you vaccinate your children? He says, hell no. But you vaccinate other people's children? Yeah. Just want to share that with you because finally, after being on the right side of this for 40 years, they finally acknowledged that aspirins are not for everyone, and about 30,000 Americans, more or less, are dying every year from just taking the aspirins, not from the heart attacks that occur from the homocysteine. Just the aspirin itself can kill you, causing bleeding. Anyhow, this is from the University of Alberta. This just came in this morning. Quote, Canadians told to stop taking aspirin because potential harm outweighs benefits. Quote, if you've never had a heart attack or a stroke, you likely should not be taking aspirin to prevent them. And this is the most significant practice-changing evidence to come out of the past year, end quote, said family medicine professor at the University of Alberta and the co-author of a paper published in the Canadian Family Physician, a peer-reviewed journal. And this was based upon three large randomized placebo-controlled studies that showed the risk of major internal bleeding associated with taking an aspirin a day, higher than any preventative benefits. Well, based upon that, and they're right, but think of how many hundreds of thousands of Americans, Canadians, have died because of being on the wrong side of that information. Were you in this audience, at least you would have been on the right side. So now let's hope that some physicians stop. Even putting that article out, telling them stop, doesn't mean that it's all going to stop. It doesn't work that way. That's the latest on health and healing, saving some lives, letting us live a longer life. Oh, and by the way, Rambam Medical Center in Israel just had an article came out today that says pomegranates are found to prevent coronary artery disease progression. So clean your arteries with pomegranate. It works. I recommend pomegranate all the time. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Atherosclerosis that confirms pomegranate extract, pomegranate juice, pomegranate concentrate, and most importantly, most powerful, pomegranate powder can prevent and even reverse primary pathology associated with cardiac mortality, death. How about that? Once again, but I know it does more. It lowers the level of oxidative stress. It reduces monocyte chemotactic protein 1, a chemical messenger, what is called a chemokine associated with inflammation process in the arteries. It reduces lipid accumulation in the heart muscle. It reduces macrophage infiltration in the heart muscle. It reduces the level of monocyte protein 1 and fibrosis in the mitochondrium. It reduces cardiac enlargement. It reduces ECG abnormalities. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Get this information into the hands of Bernie Sanders, please. We all respect Bernie's desire to see it be a better world. He certainly would be a better representative than the one we have now. But he's made a lot of mistakes with this diet, and it's caught up to him. So if he wants, just let him read clinical nutrition and pomegranate juice consumption for 3 years by patients with carotid artery stenosis reduces common carotid intima media thickness, blood pressure, and LDL oxidation, meaning bad arteries. That's what he has. That's why he has the stent. And stents are not a cure. They're only a temporary Band-Aid to save a person's life. We could reverse his heart condition and get him vitally healthy. He could be a model for what a person could be in their health at his age. That could help, no matter what his office, his next office position is. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break and come back. We have a lot to share. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Joining us on the phone from upstate is our producer, Richard Gale. Hi, Richard.
Good afternoon, Gary.
Richard, I'd like for you to take the reins now because we are in full support of the message of Greta. Richard and I have seen through someone that we work with in publishing who is Swedish and knows a lot of the people there and got our articles, very in-depth articles that all of you should be reading, which are on PRN.fm, on the environment, the problems and the solutions, as well as three documentaries showing the problems and solutions into Greta's hands. Our hope is that she uses them. Now, we have to make sure we do not conflate two issues. We need, the world needs, a young firebrand who cannot be corrupted, who is coming from a very idealistic and pure mindset that we've got a problem. The adults have screwed it up. She's right. She got in their face. She is right. She was intemperate in her tone. She was right. And she said to Davos, to the British Parliament, to the French Parliament, to the American Congress, to the United Nations and the Spanish, you're all the problem. You're the problem. You're doing nothing. You talk, you don't do anything. She is correct. But the youth don't have any experience with the environment except enjoying it. They don't know how the problems were formed or what the solutions are. But she has been given a list of solutions. Richard and I have seen that those solutions get into her hands. Our hope is that she uses them. Because if she chooses to use these solutions, then we can start seeing immediately a paradigm shift with millions of children beginning become not only aware there's a problem, but more importantly, engaged in the solutions. So, Richard, I'm turning over to you to share the solutions, not just for Greta and the people she's motivating, but also everyone else in this audience.
Yes. Well, Greta is a recent sensation. What I find is that all this attention on Greta has been ignoring the fact there have been other young environmental leaders out there who have been in the for quite a while now. The woman, Jamie Margolin, who was one of the founders of the Zero Hour, they've been very active in doing all kinds of things in Washington State and Seattle for years. There's a lot of young Native American youth that are coming up and speaking on the environment and organizing protests and all. So I think there's been a little too much attention on Greta, and we're missing the point of other young activists, environmental, ecological, and climate activists, who should also be getting a lot of attention. I think it's perfectly fine for the children to continue to protest. I can understand the value of, striking from school and as a way for the kids and the teens to all get together and be able to share, and because they're coming from all different high schools when they gather together. So there's a lot of exchange. But I think the students can also, and this would be one of my messages, is to also use your schools, your colleges, and universities as an avenue, a venue, in order to further promote the message that they're trying to get across, because there's so much that can be done. I have a 16-year-old daughter, so I'm the same age as Greta, so I'm familiar with how obstinate the younger generation can be when it comes to trying to reach out or wanting to reach out for guidance or advice from myself or from any of the older generations, because properly they don't trust us very much. And Greta, I think, is probably far more trusting than some of these other younger activists that are out there today. So one doesn't need to leave school and strike in order to have a profound impact. There's so much that could be done at the schools and colleges, like coordinating events at classes, lectures, to bring people in to speak about the future that they're going to be entering, and better ways that they're going to be able to navigate their future. We're probably at a time in history when never before is education probably more important to become educated about the world we live in, because we live in a world of fake news and lies and deceit. It's so difficult for so many people to be able to make heads or tails out of what is true or not. So there's so much they could be doing just on their campuses and trying to transform the schools themselves in order to address these ecological issues. They could bring people in for ecological and health benefits on a plant-based diet, or bring local environmental community organizers to speak about benefits for urban farming or buying local. You might remember there was the E.F. Schumacher movement, that came out of Small is Beautiful, the SLOW movement, which is learning how to minimalize our lives so we can take enjoyment out of not having to own a lot and just to be consumers. That was a movement that started, first half of the 20th century. There are many Native American spiritual voices that can speak about our connection with nature and our responsibility to protect it. Those are other kinds of events they could bring on campuses. And, of course, then there's the health and energy risks of just too much exposure to electronics, because the younger generation are going to have to live with 5G much longer than we will. So they're being confronted with another threat that will also have to a detriment of the environment and energy consumption as well. So those are just some of mine.
Okay, Richard, let's go over a few of those in detail. So here's a project for all parents to work with their if you have teenagers, to be a part of this movement. There's a brilliant BBC special documentary on Wi-Fi, and it was one of those rare situations where they got into schools, went into the study rooms, classrooms, where all these 5G computers are set up, and they put a monitor exactly where a child's head would be leaning towards a computer. And they showed that very dangerous levels of electromagnetic frequencies. And no matter which school they went into, no matter which computer they were at, they were all dangerous. This is in every school in England. It's also all in every school in the United States, because almost every school has Wi-Fi. But now not only do they have Wi-Fi, every airplane has Wi-Fi. And if you look down, there's Wi-Fi on every seat. That's dangerous. Not just for you, but also frequent flyers, the flight attendants, and the pilots. But no one's being told the truth. So what Richard and I have done, we've collected the best, most accurate, and scholarly documentaries from around the world on the dangers of the devices young people and adults use, laptops, cell phones, and, of course, Wi-Fi, and 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So to educate yourself, when you watch this, and it's very realistic because you're going into a school, then they go out of the school, and they're walking. They have to walk almost a half a mile away before you're out of the signal. That means everyone in that school, in the classrooms, it's the highest level, but in the hallways, the cafeteria, in the auditorium, when you're outside, in the parking area, the playground, the soccer fields, football fields, you're getting bombarded. And in one school alone, there were four different cases of children developing cancer, and the parents were enraged, and they made the school take down the 5G tower. 5G is a reality. We're not paying attention. I led two different demonstrations when I was recently in New York against it, but I'm just one person of limited resources, reaching just a relatively tiny amount of people compared to the number of people that are out there. So that's why to share what you learn. But if she were to begin to share that information, I'm talking about Greta. If Greta Thunberg were to share that information on just Wi-Fi to get it out of our schools, we don't need it, and go back to learning from textbooks, which is a better way of learning. And every study shows that when you read from a textbook, you retain more than if you read off a computer. That would be a big movement. Just that itself would save countless lives and suffering and environmental illnesses and brain cancers in the future. She could do the same thing with cell phones. Now, here's what would happen. At a certain point, when a movement is so large that it's going to stop buying a product, the industry itself to survive will change gears, and they will create non-poisonous alternatives. If you create a movement for enough organic, people will then start growing organic. If there are three or four in a city, no one's going to grow organic for you. There's economy of scale. She is the person capable of creating economy of scale by saying, we're not going to buy your product, we're not going to use your product. And if she stops using the product, that makes a difference. If she stops saying, don't buy the genetically modified veggie burger from Burger King, and now McDonald's got theirs coming, don't buy any meat. And then she circulated throughout the network all the different film clicks. We have hundreds of these films that we have collected in our resource center so that we can give them free to people so they have the tools to make changes in their lives. So start with 5G, cell phones, laptops, and Wi-Fi in schools. That's good. Go to a plant-based diet. Also, I'm going to suggest, in fact, this afternoon we're sending Greta another letter, and in the letter we're suggesting that at every school in America that has any land at all, most do, except some of the inner city schools, that they put in there a petting zoo where you take animals and you have someone, people who are responsible for them, but then the students can go and play with them and hug them and be near them and see that these are wonderful, these are sentient creatures. Isn't it better to pet that lamb than to have a rack of lamb? Isn't it better to have that little heifer with the big, beautiful eyes licking you on the side of the face than to have it as a hamburger? Children are extremely open to influencing them at the heart level, especially something that warms their heart that they can naturally and through intuition vibrate with and say, this is right. This is right. Love an animal. Don't eat an animal. She could do that. And we could go from what is about 5% vegetarians in the world or in the United States today. It's much higher in Europe. And by the way, 80% of all vegans are liberal. And the highest group are progressives. So those of us who are progressives, who started from a more liberal perspective, but broke free of the corporatist neoliberal policymakers to think independently, we're the largest single group representing those who believe in the sacredness of animals. So that's two very important things that could happen, because then the films that you could share in schools that a teenager could fully understand is, here's what happens to the soil when you allow it just to grow wild, or you grow biodynamically on it. And here's how you nourish the soil. Now, here's commercial soil where you only grow genetically engineered crops. Here is every 60 seconds, three soccer fields are destroyed of woods and land in the Amazon to grow soybeans to feed the cattle. And then they began to see this. Oh, now I understand. With all those trees, they absorb carbon and they give off oxygen. We need more oxygen. We need less carbon. That's a good thing. So let's stop eating hamburgers, and therefore we protect the Amazon. And then you go through each thing that a child does, and you take something that they are not aware of, and you make them aware that there's a natural alternative. So that's what we're suggesting. Also, before we go, I was listening to someone criticize, and without any context or accuracy, Andrew Wakefield. Oh, you know, he's a fraud and exploiting autistic children, etc. None of that is true. Richard and I did more to defend Wakefield after we spent a half year verifying for ourselves, researching for ourselves, that he was innocent. In fact, many of you remember the day about, what was it, about 7-8 years ago, where we did a seven-hour nonstop marathon, Andrew Wakefield, where I debated his attacker for an hour. Well, since that time, the news has been completely wrong. CNN has been wrong. Tell us now why Andrew Wakefield was exonerated and Dr. Smith, the most famous gastroenterologist in the world, was also vindicated. The news didn't even touch it.
Yes, so the charges against Dr. Wakefield can't be separated from the charges that were directed against Dr. John Walker Smith. They were both colleagues together working with the 12 children that were in the study. So when the General Medical Council, which is the legal ruling body on medical crimes and misdemeanors and all, when they took Walker Smith and Wakefield to court, it was they were being charged with having failed to obtain the necessary ethical clearances for subjecting these 12 children to what the court was ruling as unnecessary and perhaps dangerous medical procedures. That was the base. That was the fundamental basic charge. Dr. Wakefield, of course, did not have the funding to repeal. Dr. Walker Smith did, and it seems like Walker Smith had much more support from the British medical community as well. He was held a senior position at the Royal Hospital where they were both doing this work. So the GMC and conclusions were that there was the trial was based on inadequate and superficial reasoning, and therefore the finding of there being serious professional misconduct and the removal of their licenses was erroneous. So Professor Walker Smith was cleared. However, on the other, Andy still remains in limbo over this, and he is still being used as a scapegoat for starting the hysteria over the safety and efficacy of vaccines. He's still the goat.
Okay, but that Richard. Richard, what's important is that Andrew Wakefield and Dr. Smith and their entire team were initially challenged under the all identical charges. But Andrew Wakefield did not have any money to defend himself. Walker Smith was able to get the money and went in and was cleared of all charges. They were 100% cleared. So by clearing Walker Smith, by extension, Andrew Wakefield, who was under the same charges, was also cleared. So the idea is, though it didn't happen in a court yet because he didn't have the money to get to court, if two people are charged for the same identical misconduct and one is cleared but the other couldn't afford an attorney, then you must assume that since they were both charged equally, they are both equally not guilty. That's what any reasonable person would do. And I suggested in the last time I spoke with Andrew Wakefield, whatever it takes, borrow the money, get the money, go back to court, open it up like Walker Smith and 100% clear yourself, and then sue the hell out of the people who attacked you, including those on CNN, including and specifically Anderson Cooper. Thank you much, Richard.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
All right.
Our guest is on now. I mentioned his background a little earlier, Dr. Thomas Cowan. And he is a longtime physician who has practiced complementary and alternative medicine out in San Francisco. He is a former vice president of the Physicians Association for Anthroposophic Medicine, based on the teachings of Rudolf Steiner, and was a founding member of the Weston Price Foundation. His practice incorporates nutrition, homeopathy, and anthroposophic medical theory and botanical herbs. He also runs a family biodynamic organic operation, and he writes the column Ask the Doctor for the magazine Wise Traditions in Food, Farming, and Healing Arts, and has authored several books, including Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and The Changing Nature of Childhood Illness. His most recent work, released a couple weeks ago, is Cancer and the New Biology of Water, Why the War on Cancer Has Failed and What That Means for More Effective Prevention and Treatment. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Almost every week, there are new studies that are identifying some new gene that is associated with cancer or other diseases, and these genes in turn become targets for the development of new drugs. That's the dominant medical paradigm, and that's what we've been living with for decades. With respect to cancer, it is the oncogene theory, the belief that cancer is solely caused by activated oncogenes due to mutations in normal cell division. However, when it becomes looking at cancer honestly, almost all cancer treatments would either target these genes or bombard cancer cells with chemotherapy and radiation. Modern medicine has been totally at the losing end of this, and human beings have died at more than 550,000 per year who only did orthodox therapy. And as you note, the war on cancer since the oncogene theory became the standard model for understanding cancer has been a failure. So please take your time and explain the reasons why the war on cancer has failed, and then also use the example, and I'm going to give you Angelina Jolie. Why? Because Angelina Jolie was used as the model of good behavior and right thinking when she had her completely healthy, normal breasts removed in radical mastectomy, double mastectomy, and she had her uterus removed because she had the gene. She had no cancer. She had no symptoms. And so then her message was, if you have this gene, get your ovaries removed, have a hysterectomy, get your breasts removed to save your life in the future. And I'm thinking, my God, when the governor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller's wife, had her breasts removed, it wasn't because she had cancer. She had the genes, and that's when all this was starting. And I studied this very carefully. I have found no compelling science that supports that if you have the genes, the BRCA genes, you're going to end up with a cancer. And even if it did mean, there's so many other things in your lifestyle that you can do to change the outcome of gene expression. The form is yours.
Okay, so just the background here, which you I think went over here, but in 1971, Richard Nixon announced the war on cancer. And the reason he did was because we, quote, found the reason why people have cancer. And that is, as you described, we have these, 23 pairs of chromosomes. 22 of them are somatic, and then there's an XX and an XY. And the theory was there's a mutation on one of the, or an error, mutation sort of means error, in one of these chromosomes. So the chromosomes house the genes, and the genes make proteins, and the proteins essentially run the cell and run biology. So the theory was we found these errors in these chromosomes, and they cause cancer. In the beginning, the hope and the theory was there's going to be a specific mutation for prostate cancer and a different one for breast cancer and a different one for pancreatic, et cetera, et cetera. or that, you know, in any one person, they have a specific mutation. One of the two was the hope. So that, you know, since 1971, the promise was, now that we know the cause, give us 10 years, we will cure cancer, nobody will die of cancer. The reality is, I don't know the exact number, but it was about 1 in 5 people got cancer in 71. Now it's 1 in 2, and the death rate, you know, has, if anything, increased since then. There was some very interesting analysis of this, two of which I talked about in my book. One was a German biostatistician named Ulrich Abel, who in the early 90s did a study of how effective chemotherapy, the main treatment for these cancers, were. And he said in stage 3 and 4 that chemotherapy improves the outcome by 2.3%, which is basically nothing. And this was widely criticized, and then the Australian government did another study in the early 2000s, and they looked at all stage cancers, all chemotherapy. The improvement was 2.9%, which is basically the same and also nothing. So, you know, like most wars that Americans do, this one has failed to improve outcomes of any significance and is just a unbelievably expensive, you know, I don't know how much money has been spent on this, but biotech, et cetera, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, the problem, as I described in the book, which is very simple in a way, they eventually did studies, which I reference in my book, and a guy named Thomas Seyfried, he talks about this in The Metabolic Causes of Cancer. It's very simple. So the cell has essentially two parts. It has a cytoplasm, which is essentially the watery part, and then it has a nucleus that hosts houses the DNA, which have the genes. So this has been repeated over and over again, which is, you know, you take a healthy cell, two healthy cells, you take the nucleus of the healthy cell and put it in the other one, the progeny are healthy. Then you take a cancer cell and you take the nucleus out of the cancer cell and you put it into a healthy cytoplasm and the progeny are normal. And then you take a nucleus from a healthy cell and put it into the cytoplasm of a cell with cancer, and the progeny are cancerous. In other words, you can't have any clear demonstration that the site of cancer, the problem with cancer, lies in the cytoplasm, not the nucleus. Now, this has been repeated over and over again. And interestingly, the researchers often will say things like, well, that must mean somehow the healthy cytoplasm knows how to fix the oncogenes, which is ridiculous. The problem is not in the genes. It's not that there isn't mutations or aren't mutations. It's not that mutations don't cause trouble. The origin of the problem is in the cytoplasm, not the nucleus. I can't emphasize that enough. You know, the analogy that I used in my book was, it's like you come up upon a guy who's looking for something under a street light, and you say, what are you looking for? He says, my keys. And so you help him look for a minute, and then you say, where do you think you lost your keys? He said, over there in the bushes. And so we say, why are you looking under the streetlight? He says, because the light's better. So that's essentially what we've done for 50 years, hundreds of billions of dollars. We're looking under the light. The problem is, even though it's thornier and darker and all that in the bushes, that's where the problem is. It's in the cytoplasm. And that means we have to understand what the cytoplasm is, and how it functions, and exactly how the cytoplasm defects cause cancer.
Could you thank you, I appreciate that. Could you very briefly, because we're run out of time, explain in lay language the cytoplasm and what makes it defective and how we can keep it stronger?
So the cytoplasm, I would, you know, has now been, we now know, and you can see it, is basically structured water, which means, you know, water exists in four phases, not the three that we were told. And the fourth phase is a gel. And so here's how it works. One of the central observations that you can make with cancer is it feels different than the surrounding tissue. In other words, if you have a breast, it feels soft, and then you come to the lump, and it feels hard. Why is the lump hard? Because the density of the cells is too much. And this is the same with all cancers. The density of the cells is too high. So then you ask, well, how does the density come about? And the density comes about because we have a charge around our cells, so that cells have essentially an electromagnetic field. And when two negatively charged cells come together, they repel each other, keep their distance, and that creates healthy tissue. So then the question is, where does the charge come from? And this has perplexed scientists for centuries, and they found out that it comes because of the distribution of sodium, potassium across the membrane. The sodium is out and the potassium is in, and that difference creates the charge. Next question, how does that come about? We're told that it's because of a pump in the membrane, sodium-potassium pump. But that's actually not true. There is a pump, but it doesn't do that, and I can't get into the reasons I know that, but I describe it in my book. But what really happens is the cytoplasm is a gel. By some miracle of nature, the gel is so constituted that it attaches to potassium, excludes sodium, creates the charge around the cell. Charged cells keep their distance, and that creates healthy, living, active tissue. When the charge is lost because the gel deteriorates, because either the water isn't right or there's some factors destroying your gels, then you can't have a charge. The cells then clump together and form cancer. It's very specific, it's very clear, and then all one has to do is to understand how water is formed properly. And the answer to your question, how is it formed properly, what can we do? Well, we know that if you take a beaker of water and you want to form a gel, if you shine the sunlight on it, it forms better gels. If you put it directly in contact with the earth, it forms gels. If you put your hands on it, it forms gels. If you put your dog next to it, it forms gels. If you put your cell phone next to it, the gel deteriorates. So how do you deteriorate the gels so they can't create a charge? Well, one answer is put toxins, you know, like glyphosate, aluminum, all that stuff that we inject into people. You put that in the water, the gels can't form. Why do we get fevers? We get fevers to dissolve the gels, to excrete all these poisons and reconstitute better gels. You put an electromagnetic field, and I know you've done some amazing work on 5G and the trouble that that's going to cause. You put that non-native electromagnetic field near your gels, and it deteriorates. You can't form a charge. You have a dead or dysfunctional cell. That's what we call cancer.
Really well said in a concise way. But I'm going to invite you back for a full hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour so we can go into greater depth on the difference between living food diets and creating that gel, adulterated diets and destroying the gel, living in a near nature with trees and shrubs and water and the ocean and lakes and streams, putting our feet in the soil, creating the gel, and living in artificial environments with excessive stimulation and electromagnetic frequencies and destroying the gel, being mindful, creating the gel, being stressed, distressing the gel, destroying the gel. The very things that we've been doing, just different labels, but it's all the same. Clean, detoxify, energize, and honor life, and you prevent cancer. I'm going to invite you back, Dr. Thomas Cowan. In the interim, the book is called Cancer and the New Biology of Water. I'll give you just the main title. And his website is Dr. Cowan, C-O-W-A-N-S, Garden, G-A-R-D-E-N.com. Nice to have you with us today. Thank you. We'll have him back. We'll have him back for a full hour, hopefully this Tuesday evening on Progressive Commentary Hour. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.